I Okay, folks, so this is the first lecture for Informatics 1, Logic and Computation. Everybody believe they're in the right lecture? Yes, good. Okay, so I'm Dave Robertson. For a few of you, at least I saw you before. There was a bit of a mix-up, I think. Some people end up in JCMB rather than in the Appleton Tower for the introductory bit for informatics. So I'm the head of School of Informatics, and I also give the logic and computation lectures to you guys. So what I wanted to do in the first lecture was just say a little bit to introduce you to logic and computation, and then give you the very first bit of this. Now, you should be getting a pack of information. I thought it would actually be here, because it is prepared. It may not be till the next lecture, actually. I'm not quite sure the IT have got it all prepared. But what you should find is you get a bunch of the lecture notes, lecture slides, I believe also the tutorial exercises in one go right at the beginning, so that you have all that you've got it, and you can read it at your leisure through the course. So that should happen. I thought it would be here today, but I don't see it. Maybe it's tomorrow. Okay, so a little bit of the kind of motivation for this first. Maybe, is this good for light? Should I do that and dim it a little bit? Is that better? I reckon that's better. Yeah. Okay. Right. So that picture maybe overwhelms it a little bit, but the idea here is that one of the things that you'll be noticing a lot, I suppose, in your real life is that a whole lot of things are increasing all at once. If you could read this properly, this would the numbers of nodes on the network, the number of people who are connecting, the amount of data that's at the edge on your phones and devices and so on, the amount of bandwidth you use for doing all the stuff you want to do with video, the amount of computing resource that you use when you're accessing very, very large server farms in order to get something done on, say, Google or something like that, the complexity of the services that you use, how many different things get interconnected in order to do the things that you want to do, and the amount of connectivity that you've got when you link in your phone or whatever it is to the network. A lot of these things are growing at really ever-increasing rates, so very, very fast indeed. But the other thing that you might not have noticed so much is that natural systems are kind of the same. And they're starting to be understood as information processing. So some of the things that you'll see more things like to do with genetic codes, gene sequencing, cell signaling, people building models of those sorts of things, and synthetic biology. Things to do with population dynamics, understanding ecology, climate change, those kinds of things. Social behavior, social computation, and those sorts of things are all things that are now being understood as informatics type things rather than my first degree was actually as a biologist, and I actually did some computation then, but that was quite rare at that time. And now it's quite common, if you're a biologist, to study biology and then spend the rest of your career never near a biological system, but just working with data, because it's much faster to get experimental results out that way. So life is changing quite a lot. And as things change, then there are things that you need to know now, and that's all the things that change. It's all the things about what's the most popular device to buy, or what's at the forefront of gene sequencing technology, and all of those things you just need now to do what you want to do. And then kind of underneath all of that, there are things that are very stable in theory, and those are things that are always true, and they actually don't change, actually. Doesn't matter what system you're looking at, it doesn't matter what type of technology it is, those things will be the same. And mostly we're going to be here, but I'll try and talk a little bit about the stuff that goes up here to connect it. All I'm really doing is connecting it. Our business is here in this course. And that's one of the things that I think is important about both. Phil Wadlow can talk about the functional programming. I think he may have a similar view. My view of the value of the computational logic course for you just now, immediately, is it is this fundamental, foundational side of things that I want to put in place. Okay, but there is a tight link. So the way these things interact typically is got people working here. I mean, this isn't the sort of thing that it just stays absolutely constant forever, because the nature of the systems that are of interest to look at here change depending on what happens here. So there is interaction. I mean, people here typically look and see what's going on. The things that are research that's relevant in theory in informatics and computer science does actually change. The emphasis changes. It builds incrementally because what you've done is always true.
So you do it, you finished, you know, there you are. But there's always more and more and more and more to find as the scope of the field increases. You're never quite finished, so you're always trying to observe things here and see what more you need to do. And then application carries things up. Most of, maybe it's actually all, I'm not sure, I guess. Well, it depends on how you count. But certainly the vast majority of things that make a difference up here are traceable back to things that were done here. So both those sides should work. And here are some examples of the sort of things you find, just to make it a little bit more concrete. Here are examples of the sort of things you see here. These things you will kind of know a little bit about. So programming is up here, at least the bit of it that's to do with designing particular languages and marketing them and building things with them and so on is up here. Circuit design, things like the internet, device controls, neural systems, all of those kinds of things are things that are more in this kind of space here. Here, you have things that could apply across any of those, really. Notions of grammars or verification or systems of proof, or things that are even more fundamental things really down at the bedrock, like things like deduction and state, those sorts of concepts, they're never ever going to change. All of these systems up here have state. Very many of them will do something that can be understood as some sort of deduction, can be understood logically. So these things never, ever, ever change. Some of these things, maybe they change a bit more because they're closer to here. It's that kind of thing. The big question for you might be,
you might understand what I just said, but think, yeah, that's okay for an academic to say, but what's the point practically?
And actually, one of the things that people don't quite realize is a lot of the things that you might do in theory actually sometimes are immediately practically useful later on. Here's a quote that I got from, Prolog is a logic programming language. I'm a fan of logic programming languages. I might even tell you a little bit about that towards the end of the course, if there's time. So this is a particular type of language, and this is a guy who was being interviewed, and it made a difference. It makes you a little bit distinctive, actually, if you know a little bit more about the foundations of the discipline that you're in. And actually, from a practical point of view, here's an example of somebody where it did actually make a difference in the job market. So this guy had been employed by the person that they were, the company they were talking about, I can't tell you which company it is, was very grateful to be able to know about these kinds of things because it makes you a little bit distinctive. Many people in informatics, I think it's a flaw, a very, very deep flaw in the way that we teach students about informatics, is often you learn just to use the tools. Here's the tools. But you don't really know why, you don't know, underneath it all, you don't know what makes everything the same. And therefore, your whole career is just driven by understanding a very focused, narrow set of tools. And that's the wrong way to do it. And from a practical point of view, many employers that are worth being employed by understand this, at least to some degree. So that's the practical reason. Okay, a little bit about the resources for the course. There's a website. Go and have a look at it. You'll find on the website all the lecture notes for the course. You'll find the lecture slides on the course on the website. I reserve the right to change these, so you can look ahead at them. But I'm not going to, It might be that I decided I want to change things a little bit. The general tenor of it will be the same, though. The stuff that you see there in the slides in the lecture course is what I'm going to go through. What I may change a little bit is maybe a little bit of the way I've explained it or something, just once we see how we go. There's a tutorial each week. You'll get at the exercises. Should get them all out in one big lump in, I hope, the next lecture. And then you just use them each week. You'll hear more about the organization of that from the ITO. I'm not going to talk about this at the moment, because we'll leave it a little bit till you settle in. But the other thing that we've got on this course is we have a set of online exercises, a system called WebCT. It doesn't really matter what that is. It's just a system that you can access. A little bit later we'll tell you how. And it gives you essentially another way of studying the course. Do not rely on it entirely. I think of it as being just a second strand that you can dip into when you're not following the lectures or doing the tutorials or something. If you feel like you need a little bit more help, you want to self-test yourself on some of the things, there's a bit of practice, you go to WebCT and you'll find lots of exercises.
And they should synchronize with the lecture notes. So you can go through, if you're a particular stage in the course, a particular stage in the lecture notes, you can go to it and you're thinking, gee whiz, I could do a little bit more practice of this. Go to WebCT and you'll find some self-testing stuff there. And so we put in a bit of care to try and get these to synchronize nicely. I hope that will be a lot of help. The other thing that you will find is that videos will also appear on that website of me giving lectures. So that's also, I think, quite useful. What I found, we did an entire video series for the course last year for the first time. And to my surprise, that was actually very popular. I think about 3/4 of the class actually downloaded all the videos, which I can't imagine was for fun, because they're not that entertaining. So I imagine what that was for was because people quite liked the idea of being able to look over some of the things that were said, you know, for a revision or just to refresh what was going on, or maybe you missed a lecture or something, you could go and have a look at that. So that's yet another way of being able to get a bit of the course. So lots of different ways of getting the information you need. They should all be complementary in the sense that the videos will be, you know, the lectures follow the lecture notes, the WebCT stuff follows the lecture notes. So it should be that you can just go through and pick and choose, as suits you, the best way of getting the help that you need to understand things. Okay, happy with all of that. Good. Okay, so into the logic. So you'll find that the course is computational logic, and basically it's in two halves. The first half is logic, and the second half is to do with state, finite state machines. Remember at the earlier on I was saying, at the very bedrock of everything, there's kind of two things, and it's logic and deduction, and it's state, and pretty much everything you can understand that way. A lot of systems I'll give you, and a lot of the examples I'll give you, will be quite simple ones, because they need to fit in a lecture. But I'll try and extrapolate them a little bit as I go through. And this is my favorite quote from Zohar Mana and Richard Waldinger. It's really logic is the calculus of computer science. It's the way, if you really want to be specific and precise about how it is that you understand the things that go on in computer science, logic is typically where you end up. Okay, so first bit, I'm going to talk to you about a little bit about describing things in logic. Describing things in logic is hard. I've been at that sort of game one way or another for more than 20 years now, and I'd still say I'm learning things about how to describe logic. So there's no way in this course that you're going to be completely proficient at being able to describe all sorts of different systems in logic. Don't expect to. It's not required of you. What's required of you is to understand a few simple principles about how to do that kind of thing, and enough that later on you would have much less difficulty in learning as you go through. So ambitions are not sky high. Another thing you have to understand about logic, if you go back to the literature and start looking, if you've never looked before, some of you may have actually been exposed. Actually, how many of you have seen logic before in some way? Typically, it's people in philosophy or... quite a few. How many, actually, that's a good question. How many of you have been exposed to logic in, say, philosophy, understood broadly? Quite a few. How many in maths? About the same number. How many in computation, like a logic programming language? Okay, quite a lot, but slightly different hands. So this is going to be complicated. This is definitely going to be complicated to do. Because for my guess from the show of hands, maybe about half of you, one way or another, have seen some aspect of this, and about half of you have seen none at all. Okay, so we just need to be aware that that's true. Some bits in some ways it's more difficult, I think, for the people who've seen it before, because you're bound to see something that's a bit like what you saw, but it may not be in quite the way that you saw it last time. Okay. So you'll just have to do the mental adjustment, and we'll see how we go. So if people have seen it before, especially from philosophy, maybe from maths, you'll understand this, that it's really quite an old field, about as old as you can get, really. So initially, it was just studying human argument. So
people, the ancient Greeks and various other people. It wasn't not confined to there, actually, but the area where people mostly think about it, thinking about how humans argue, so really a human thing. 19th century starts to become more mathematical and therefore abstract from just purely the empirical study of how humans argue. Much more recently, studying mathematical proofs, and really only in the mid, this is the important bit, only in about the mid-20th century, where computers are starting to take off, do people start to think about logic and informatics. So what I'm describing is something that has a tremendous, some aspects of it have tremendous history, but actually the bit that actually has some traction just now is actually quite young. It's not that very far developed. But it's very useful. Here are some examples of why logic is useful. I don't want to go through these in detail. Some of them we'll come across again in the course, but just see the variety. Inside your circuit, inside your computer, is Boolean logic. Some kinds of problems that you want to deal with are the sort of problems where you can't actually build a system to solve them, but you want to know that you, in the extreme case, you want to be able to show that nobody is ever going to be able to solve this problem. How are you going to do that? Since you're never going to build the machine and get the negative result, because the machine cannot be built, logic can sometimes do that for you. It can help you explore the boundaries of things that you may not be able to build, or help you be able to see what would be the limitations on the system you might build. That's in the world of logic being used for specifications of systems. And tremendously important to cut out systems that you may or may not be able to actually achieve. Programming languages, many programming languages are close to logic one way or another. Sometimes the root is quite tortuous, sometimes, like with logic programming languages, arguably functional programming languages, the root is actually quite close. Semantics. If you want to compare languages, how? You need some gold standard to compare. Logic gives you that. Verifying systems, security protocols, and so on. We'll come on to a little bit of that later on in the course. You want languages to do that, often they're logical-based languages. Languages used in things like the semantic web, so where people are trying to structure data and use that structure to give much better data sharing, much greater ability for large volumes of information. A lot of those are logic-based. Basically, as a lingua franca, if you're an academic and you pursue this later on in the academic sphere, you will come across logic as a lingua franca in most areas that you're working. So you need it for nearly everything. All my lectures, I like to do it kind of this way. So this is the first example of this. I like to give you a little motivating problem at the beginning for you to think about solving, and then we talk about some stuff that you need to solve it, and then we come back to the problem at the end. Okay. So most of my lectures are going to be like this, so you might as well get used to it now. So here's a little motivating problem. And actually, this is talking about data. What you're going to use this convention, that if I say film, something or it. So lowercase means it's a constant, uppercase means it's a variable, something that can vary, okay? And I'm not going to spend a lot of time plowing through a whole lot of syntax. I need to do that a little bit, but I'll try and do that gently, because if I just spend an entire lecture on logical syntax, you're going to get very bored, and I don't want to get bored right at the beginning. So we'll just kind of wing it through this for this lecture. So that's a constant, and that's F is a film. So film F means F is a film. Actor, some F, some P, means that person P acted in film F. Director F, P, means that some person P directed film F. Oscar for something means that X got an Oscar. Could be a film, could be a person, because both films and people get Oscars, right? So that's what I take this particular bit of syntax to mean. Syntax is just the structure of the language we use. Semantics is what I just told you. That's what these things are intended to mean. And I've given you an informal semantics for those particular expressions. Actually, already, this notation is a little bit more complex than the notation you'll typically use. So don't get scared by it. In fact, most of what I'll talk to you is using a system called propositional logic, which doesn't have any of these scary variables in it. Okay. So here's a little example of this language being used. This says Mars Attacks is a film, great film. Tim Burton directed it, Jack Nicholson acted in it, Glenn Close acted in it, Jack Nicholson got an Oscar, Glenn Close got an Oscar. Okay? Not necessarily for that film. Okay? Happy with that. That's what that's saying. The things in quotes just say that
Inside quotes, by convention, that means it's a constant. Okay, happy with that. I just described a situation.
Right. So then, here's a little question to think about. You don't know how to solve it yet, so I'll give you the nuts and bolts to solve it in the next few minutes.
Suppose we want to describe that. How could we describe these questions? I want to be able to, just to say what the question is. I don't want to, we could have some other piece of machinery to go away and answer the question for us, which we won't talk about, but just to describe the question, it'll be a bit like a database query. Which Oscar-winning films were directed by an actor? Blah, blah, blah. You can read the rest. Just take a moment and read the rest. And no, you won't be able to solve this unless you've done predicate logic before. You won't be able to solve this just sitting here. But just to see what the questions are, think about, this is the sort of thing we're going to solve in a moment.
Right. Now, to solve it, we do need, sorry, I have to give you some syntax, in your face syntax. But I'm going to rush through it very quickly. I'm not expecting you to memorize this sort of stuff just sitting here, because of course you can't. Far too sudden. Just to give you an idea of what the expressions mean. So here's a typical expression in predicate logic. This says, for all x, that funny looking upside down A means for all x, and so that's a quantifier over the variables. It's saying for, that this is for every x, whatever value I take for x here, then p, which is a predicate, p and q and r are predicates. They're the constants that apply to these arguments. P of A of x and q of x implies for some y, so that's saying for some particular y, then r of x of y holds. I made this very abstract because I don't really want to talk about some, don't want to, you to get any kind of feeling for some particular domain here. Just look at the syntax. Don't try and get any intuitions for some domain about this.
So this means implication. If this is true, then this must be true. This is conjunction. If this is true, and this that means this is true and this is true, right? So P of A of X, P is a predicate name, A is a constant because it's lowercase, X is a variable, it's uppercase. Conventions differ in logic. Sometimes you get logics where it's the other way around and constants are lowercase variables are lowercase and constants are uppercase. But I'll observe this convention all the way through. Not P means that P is not true. P and Q is just what I said. They're both true. That's called a conjunction. I often say conjunction, so that's a good one to remember. P or Q
is true.
Possibly both, so not exclusively. So it could be that both P and Q is true, or it could be that just P is true and Q is false, or it could be that Q is true and P is false. But what can't be true is that both P and Q are false. Okay, that's what or means. So that's disjunction in the slang of the field. P implies Q is just what I said. If P is true, then Q must be true. You sometimes also use double implication, which is really just P implies Q and Q implies P. In other words, P and Q are equivalent. Then for all XP, that means for all X's, P is true. For some XP
is true. That's a lot of stuff to get through in one slide. As long as you get, if you've seen this stuff before, you're going, oh yeah, I see, I saw this stuff before, yeah, tell me something new. Most of you probably haven't. Just soak it up for now, intuitively, and that'll be fine. You'll get plenty of practice in this kind of thing. Precedence is important. Here's another one where I don't want to dwell on it because it gets a little bit, it takes up too much time to explain it in detail for now. But look at
this example. Suppose I write something like this. A and B or C implies D. Now, it makes a difference how you read this. If I think it's A and B or C implies D, that's one thing. But if I actually meant A and B or C implies D, that's a different thing. That means something different. Later on, we'll be looking at how you can analyze the differences in these meanings. But for now, just take it from me. Depending on how you actually read that, it means something different. So I need to have an unambiguous reading for things like this, just to make them easy to write. I could write them like this with brackets in, which makes it unambiguous. So here you can clearly see that it's this implies that guy, and that's A and B or C, because I put the brackets in. But often you don't want to do that. And if you don't want to do that explicitly, then you need to have some notion of which operator dominates over other operators. When I look at something like this, which is the one that's up here? Oh, it's this one. it's the kind of dominant one in the expression. And then you look at the other sub-expressions and say, which one is dominant there? Okay? So the convention I'll follow is that implication and double implication dominate the most, and an or are the next most dominant, and a not is least dominant, and then if you've got equal dominance, then the one on the right dominates. So if I had A implies B implies C, it would be A implies B implies C. Okay?
So that's the way that works. So you can look in the lecture notes. There's more stuff said about precedence there if you really want the nitty-gritty on it, but it doesn't matter for now.
Okay, what does matter for now is I want to talk a little bit about different ways of describing the same thing. And here's
The sort of things I'll be talking about in the next little while are the things that make it quite difficult to actually learn the art of describing problems in logic. It's why it's tricky. It's why you're never quite sure whether any particular situation, unless you spend a long period of time on it, if it's a really big, complicated situation, that you've described it right. So I just want to point out some of the things that are difficult there. And the reason I'm doing that is not because I'm going to teach you how to overcome these problems, because for some of them there is no unique way of overcoming them. I just want you to understand that when you find it difficult, there are reasons why, and it's not just you. Right?
So there's four that I'll go through. One is to do with ambiguity, one is to do with boundaries, one is to do with equivalence, another one is to do with differences in logical systems.
So ambiguity, here's an example of ambiguity. So suppose you observe that Dave's hair is thinning. So he's losing a bit of hair, poor guy. Then how would you describe that is the issue? Would you say he's bald? Would you say he's going bald? Would you say he's partially bald? Or would you say something really very precise about this? I mean, all of them, to some extent, might, depending on what sort of problem you're trying to tackle, depending on your view of the world, depending on what you want to prove, might be appropriate. I mean, this is very nice and compact. Dave's bold, that's great. Done, very simple statement. Bold, brackets, Dave. This is much more complicated. This would require some expression where you had something where you're describing boldness, brackets, Dave, in terms of something to do with follicle density and something to do with Caucasian males and so on. So that's a much more complicated expression. It's in some sense richer. You can see more of the structure for why you believe something to be true. But on the other hand, you've had to say more. And you may not be any further ahead having said more, because I don't know whether it's actually useful to talk about Dave being 20% below. You know, maybe that's of not particularly useful thing to describe. So problems tend to be like this. There's a certain amount of ambiguity about the basic things you say and what they actually mean. And it's just inherent in most situations. Less so in many strictly, if you have some system that is very purely technical, you can filter out a lot of that ambiguity. But even in many technical systems, you have severe problems in the ambiguity in just connecting your formal expressions to the world. That very basic first step that you take where you say, I want to formally describe something, and now I will make these decisions. Another thing is boundary choices. So this is one from our example. So Oscar P means that P got an Oscar. Great, that was good. That was simple to explain. But that doesn't tell us which film they were an Oscar winner in, right? So I could have an axiom that said I could invent a new term called Oscar winner. And Oscar winner has two arguments, a person and the film in which they won an Oscar. So in the example, I don't think Jack Nicholson won an Oscar for his part in Mars Attacks. Great, so he was. He didn't get an Oscar for that. So then Oscar winner, Jack Nicholson, Mars Attacks wouldn't be true. But Oscar winner, Jack Nicholson, did he win? I can't remember what he won an Oscar for. Maybe somebody knows. Whatever it was he won an Oscar for would be true. Right? But from both of them, you could imply that he got an Oscar. Right? And so you can. So what you're really doing once you start to do that is you're starting to tease out the boundary of your system. You're describing more and more and more and more about the system that you're describing. You can make it even more complicated. When did he win an Oscar? Okay, now we need to know more about the system. And so on you go. And the trouble is that for most systems that impact on the real world, there is no, in the limiting case, there is no natural endpoint. You can keep describing everything until the whole world is somehow in your description, but you're never going to get there. So what an engineer does with logic is draw a boundary.
it this far and no further. These things are primitives and you just understand intuitively what they mean. And drawing that boundary is I was going to say it's an art. Not quite true. In many areas, it's a craft because there's so many engineers have thought about this, there is some degree of consensus. A question. Questions are good. Yeah, so yes, there's two separate things that you don't want to merge too much. They interact very, very strongly, but you don't want to merge them too much. One thing is when you've in your own mind, imagine you're a person, you're sitting here with a logical problem, and you want to describe it. You are going to have to write it down precisely in logic. But it's a real world problem. So you're going to make all sorts of decisions about what you describe. Okay? So one thing is, once you've described it, then what can you do? And the answer is lots and lots of things. So for boldness, for example, you could make the decision that the way I will resolve the ambiguity there is it will be the one talking about follicle density, and I will have these particular primitives. And then, congratulations, because you can have the whole machinery of logic to do the deductions that you want to do. Kind of once you've done that, then you're in clover. Well, depending on what it is you want to deduce, right? So that's good news. The trouble, but what I'm talking about is the step that you make from the informal world into the formal one. And there you have to make some decisions. You made the decision to put in the follicle density stuff rather than to leave it out. And, you did that. One of the reasons why you would do that would be to resolve the ambiguity in your own mind. Okay, you say, when I write down that symbol, that's what it means, and I need these symbols with that meaning. Ultimately, they have an intuitive, the primitive ones will ultimately have an intuitive meaning. If it's describing the real world, there will be some point where you say some of these symbols mean something is true. In a more technical domain, it might be, say you're building a cruise control system for a car. You will have some expressions in your specification of that system that will be accelerator is pressed. And they have a particular meaning, maybe not so so ambiguous in that particular domain, which means you press that particular pedal in this particular car. So it's those sorts of issues that I'm talking about here.
Okay.
Another thing that makes it difficult, and this next one is not one that's to do with the bridge to the real world. It's just to do with the nature of logics. Is you get lots of equivalences. So A implies B is equivalent to not A or B. Later on, we'll be going through and talking about how to compare these expressions, and I'll be giving you a method where you can convince yourself that one expression is exactly the same as another. But for now, we're going through it informally. So if it's true that A implies B is equivalent to saying not A or B, that's actually a difficult one to convince yourself of. We'll come back to that one in another lecture. Then which is it better to say? Well, that depends. Depends on what you want to prove. Depends, actually, in some areas, on who has to read the specification that you've written down and understand it and confirm that it's actually a faithful representation of the thing that you were trying to represent. Okay. That's just said what I just said. to give you some of these, all I want to do in the next few slides here is just to give you some of these. I'm not going to, in this lecture, try and convince you why A implies B is equivalent to not A or B. I'll leave that for later. We don't have time to do that right now. It will be important for me to do that, but I'm not going to do it right now. For now, just believe this one. Many people find this a little bit difficult to go through. I'll explain why in a moment. Here's one that's easier, I think. So conjunction versus disjunction. A and B is equivalent to, various things, but one of the things it's equivalent to is it's not true that A is not true or B is not true. If they're both true, it can't be true that one of them is false. Okay? That's quite a nice little bit of mental exercise. You're trying to convince yourself that that's true. Okay, so if not A or not B is true, then at least one of A or B must be false, right? If it's true that A is not true or B is not true, at least one of them must be false, right? Okay, and so if it's not true, if that what I just said is not true, then they must both be true.
So that's the same as A and B. That's quite a good thing to get. This is a good one to get you started. Think about that one. That's a good one to think about. If you find that difficult, actually, that's a good one to go away and think, well, after this lecture, go away and think about that one again, because this will prime you a little bit for what's going to happen in the next lecture. Just think of, just plow through that.
Here's the kind of dual of that. So A or B is equivalent to not A and not B. So A, not A and not B would be true if both of them were false, right? And if that's not true, then at least one of them must be true, which is what that means.
Ta-da.
And I love logic because you get these nice symmetries. Isn't that beautifully symmetrical? Look at that. All in the and a negation over or a negation over and.
Isn't that? Oh, I just loved it. I love these symmetries. They're very good.
So, and the other interesting thing here that is that we're saying the same thing here, but we don't need the and, right? There's no and in this expression. There's nots and ors. And here we're saying the same thing as an or, but we don't need the or. There's nots and ands.
So there's lots of this in logic. Okay, just lots of different things that you can... Same thing, but you're saying it in different ways. Here's another one. This is quite an interesting one as well. Or at least you can tell I like this stuff, because I find this interesting. If you don't find it interesting now, you will by the end. So imagine a world where some x, I can tell you all the instances. Bum, bum, bum. I can draw a line around all the instances. A1, A2 to AN. Okay?
If that's true, then for all x, P of x, for every x, P of x is true, is equivalent to saying P is true as A1, P is true of A2, and so on to AN. Right? If I could count them all, I can tell you where each one is, then I don't need the for all x, I can just have a big and. So that's why that looks like an A.
Think of it that way. It's a big and.
Except the nice thing, so why do you have this ever?
The reason you have this ever is sometimes you can't count all the x's. Okay, so you need to say, any x I can think of. This is another thing I like about logic. You can say, for anything I can think about, I'm not going to tell you what it is. And you can still reason about this sort of stuff. Very, very important for reasoning about systems. We're not going to be using this a lot, but I do think it's good for you to know that these things exist. Okay, and occasionally what will happen in the lecture is I'll kind of dip into, this stuff is predicate logic because you have predicates over arguments, and arguments can be variables. Okay, I don't do an awful lot with variables because it makes the lectures a lot more complicated, and it's something you don't really, really need until second year, maybe a bit later. For informatics, but I think it's good that you know a bit about it. You encroach on it in various ways in the functional programming course as well, so it's good to know about a little bit. Here's the other one, and isn't it nice? Beautiful symmetry again. Oh, I just love this symmetry. It's great because imagine we can do the same thing. I can count all the A's. The existential one, existent X such that PX, is just the same as a big OR. So if there's some x such that P of x, well, it must be P of A1 or P of A2 or whatever one it is. Okay? Or it could be more than one, but it's at least one. Right? And that's what exists x means in terms of or. Okay. Not much time. Just a few minutes, but let's try and solve our problems now. Remember the problem at the beginning about Mars attacks? What would be nice would be to hold up the original problem here and show you that. You just have to kind of hold that in your mind. Remember the predicates that we got? Actually, let's try and go back just to show you that one. There we are. There's the thing. We've got film, means F is a film. Actor FP means that person P acted in film F. Director FP means that person P directed film F. Oscar means they got an Oscar. And imagine you've got this big database. It's, I don't know, the IMDb or the one of those big databases, and they represented it this way. Then you want to ask questions like this. You want to access the Internet Movie Database that's represented in logic in my strange parallel universe. Not too far away from databases and databases schemas. You want to ask the question, which Oscar William films are directed by an actor? Let me show without taking too much time. One way to get towards this is to try and express that in a little bit more clunky way that's closer to the logic, right? So this is the same thing, I think.
but it's expressed a little bit more clunkily, so that then I'll be able to make the bridge to the mass. I want to be able to prove that there exists an Oscar-winning film with a director, and there exists a film in which that director was a film actor.
Okay. Just give you the answer to that one. Okay, so this says,
I want to prove that there's some F and P such that F got an Oscar and P was a director of F, so this is the same F here, and for some F1, not necessarily the same one, P was an actor.
Okay, so that's actually a little bit, that's actually quite a complicated thing to express, so that's reasonably difficult. I would be very surprised, unless you'd done it before, if you immediately thought,
Before I told you what the answer was, you immediately went, yeah, the answer, I can write that down.
If you never saw it before and you did what I just described immediately, wow, you're good at this. But I'd be really surprised if there's anybody in class that did that. If you'd done it before and, of course, could do it, then wow, you can remember what you did.
So this should be a little bit challenging. By the way, in the exam, just to make you feel comfortable, all of this seems really terribly challenging, in the exam, I'm not going to be giving you stuff with existential and universal quantifiers and so on. So this very first lecture, I'm giving you things that are beyond the exam. I don't mind doing that. I'll tell you the things that are in the exam. I'll tell you the things that aren't going to be in the exam in a general sense. And then we'll play around with it. You need a little bit beyond what you'd ever get examined on just to get a bit of entertainment out of the course.
But I'll try and tell you when we're going off-piste, I think, is what the skiers would say.
Okay, so there's an example of this. Let me give you another one. We're going to run out of time, but you can look at these later. Which Oscar-winning actors have directed themselves? Okay, so what you have to do is prove that exists a film and an Oscar-winning actor in it, and the same person is a director of that film.
This is what we need to be able to show on our database in order to answer that question.
There we go. So, what I want to show is there's some F and P, such that P got an Oscar, so that's the Oscar winning, and P was an actor in some film F, same P, so this is an Oscar winning actor in some film, and P was a director of that film. Same person. Same person, same film.
Next one, I'll go through these quickly because we're just nearly out of time. Which directors have directed more than one film? So then I have to show, it's a tiny, tiny little trick there. You have to show that there exist two films with the same director and they're not the same film. Okay, so if there are two films with the same director and they're not the same film, then that director must have directed more than one film. Here we go. So there's some F1, F2, and P, so P was a director of F1, and P was a director of F2, and it's not true. Actually, here's a new bit of notation, actually, so you couldn't really have done this without me giving you equal to. So F1 and F2 are the same. Okay, it should not be true that F1 and F2 are the same thing. Second last one. Which films have more than one director? There we go. Prove that there exists this film which there exists two directors and these are not the same person, essentially the same thing. Last one, have all directors been actors? So prove that all directors of films are actors in some film. Now you need an implication, so this is a bit hairier to look at, kind of threw it in as the hairy example at the end. So what this says is for every P and F1, if we have a director, P is a director of film F1, that means that there's some other film, F2, such that P was an actor in F2. That one you should find really challenging even to think about why it's right. But it's quite a nice thing now to go away at the end of the lecture and go away and think, intuitively, can I make some sense of these things? Bearing in mind that you should not be scared by this, because since I have told you that you will never be examined on things in the final exam that have variables in them, you can relax. You can look at it and think, oh, that's quite challenging, a little puzzle, a bit like doing Sudoku or something like that. It's not going to count for the exam, but it's a little bit of practice, gets me into the swing of things for the course. So kind of relax, absorb this intuitively, hope you enjoyed the first lecture, and we pick it up again tomorrow. Thanks very much for listening.
Go up to the ITO on level 4 of this building, and they'll help you with all of that. Yeah, I think just now, probably they'll be in just now, yeah.
You're not getting my umbrella. It's horrible,
isn't it? It's really, I just had to go across the
internet. Yeah, I have that thing on, so I'll be
right. Yes, you should go. Yeah, thank you. So we want the nervous moment. On.
It should be on. I'm holding my laptop and it's fine. Are you doing a PC?
Yeah.
You mind?
Yeah, go on, please.
I think this works. And that works. That should be switched
off. Oh, that's on. It's waiting for me to switch off. Good. Thank you very much.
Cheers.
Right. So you weren't talking about shells and subshells.
No, okay.
Thank you. No. Okay. Did every... Yeah. You had a hand up. Were you wanting to say something? Because I was going to say, hands up anybody who doesn't have a course enrollment form. Does everybody get one of these things? You've not got one.
There we go.
So if you fill that in and give that back to me later.